This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Gloria Richardson was born in Cambridge, Maryland, in Dorchester County, in 1922. As an African American, she grew up in segregation. In the 1960s, she would lead the Cambridge movement, demanding the end of discrimination in schools and hospitals, movie theaters, and restrooms. Now 92, Gloria Richardson is still very much watching activist movements both in Maryland and in New York City, where she lives now. I spoke with her in late March. Here's part of that conversation. A warning, at one point, Ms. Richardson uses strong language, which we've decided not to censor. Tell me about growing up in Cambridge 90-some years ago. What was that like?
Well, as you've already mentioned, it was totally segregated. So we were in, and unlike most of the South, there were five wards in Cambridge, and there was, and the second ward was totally black. So it was very easy for them in terms of recreation, of health care, the schools, education, to totally isolate us. I went to high school there. My father had a drugstore there, which after a period of time when we moved down there in around 1930s, was the only black drugstore on the Eastern Shore. But also it enabled black people in the community to get their prescriptions filled. There was, sometimes there were two doctors and one doctor, but we did not have the hospital privileges. And the two things that strike me, except for just living an ordinary life within the confines of that, we knew where not to go, was that my father died because he couldn't go into the hospital. And my uncle, who was a lawyer, also died because they had no admittance and they needed hospital care.
Tell me what happened with your father.
He had a heart attack, and he was having episodes. But when he really had a very strong heart attack, they could not hospitalize him. And my cousin had to try and take care of him at home. And that did not work out, and he died. And that was really what most of the black folks in Cambridge went through. A lot of them, which in retrospect was not that much better, in order to get hospital care, they had to go to Baltimore to Johns Hopkins, which also was segregated in the fact that they set black folks aside. And so it really wasn't top-notch regular care.
You went to college at Howard University in Washington,
yes.
D.C., and you studied what?
Well, at one point, before I went to college, I thought I wanted to be a surgeon. But when I got there, I thought that the background from the segregated school, although in terms of textbooks, we got the chemistry and the biology and things, but we were short on the lab experience, and I was scared to death when I saw the laboratories and stuff up at Howard that I would just flunk right out. And so my parents went to the registrar and we changed it to sociology. And in the end, but I got married first, I wanted to be a social psychiatrist and wanted to go out to the University of Chicago. But then I got married and had children first, and that went by the wayside.
Well, what brought you back to Cambridge after college?
My mother had breast cancer, and she had been to Provident Hospital in Baltimore for an operation, and she was back home with a nurse recuperating, and my grandmother and grandfather thought I should be there. I probably, now knowing as much as I do about breast cancer, would have thought that too. But I went home, and then I met my first husband, and after about a year, got married. And so remained there.
Raising and had kids and raised them there.
Yes.
Cambridge is not a very big town. The population today is about 12,000.
And it was about that then, between 12 and 13,000, yes.
I want our listeners to hear a clip from a conversation that you had in March 1964, 50 years ago, with the writer Robert Penn Warren.
Well, I think any time you have these racial disturbances, I think they're more violent because when employment levels are low, everybody's fighting for their own particular self-preservation. And when new jobs come up, of course, the whites feel that they should have them. Usually they do, to the exclusion of the Negro.
How was employment handled in Cambridge?
They didn't post the jobs. And then by the time I came along, people knew that there was, if they heard of the job, it was no reason to apply for it. And one of the things that also was done immediately was to place, although she didn't work out too well, to place a black woman in the state employment office in Cambridge, so that at least people would know what jobs were listed and open. And I think in that, in those two, the urban renewal piece and that, were the first pieces that happened in terms of jobs.
You described to us how SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, got involved in Cambridge, and at some point along the way, you and others founded the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee, CNAC.
That's right.
But I understand that the nonviolence part of it wasn't that important to you. Am I right?
No, you're exactly right.
Why not?
I just looked at it as a tactic, not as a strategy. I think both for a long time, SNCC and certainly Martin thought of it as a strategy. I thought of it as a tactic. I had no interest in, as soon as a demonstration or picketing was over and had been legally done, and interfering with people protecting themselves. And sometimes, admittedly, it may have been only 5 or 10 minutes difference between the two kinds of activities. But we had people white folks were coming into the second ward, to firebomb and stuff. So why would you sit there and let that happen just out of some Christian principle?
Well, you just made a reference to Martin, which I assume was Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, yes.
And you said that for him, nonviolence was a tactic.
No, I think it was a strategy. I think he and John Lewis believed that.
But you don't.
No.
I understand that your daughter once asked you to leave a picket line because you were not sufficiently nonviolent.
That's when the parents didn't know they could go on the picket lines at first. And I went out one Saturday, and I don't know what, because I was a grown 40-year-old woman, but these people going by, calling you nigger and stuff, and so I stuck out my foot to trip them. And it was like a reversal. And she said, "Ma, I saw that. Get off the line." And so I was so stunned, because she was captain of the line. I was so stunned at her putting me off. I got off, but I didn't go back to picket anymore like that. I went back in demonstrations and stuff until they asked me not to lead them, because white folks had gotten so enraged that it attracted more violence on the lines against us. I think the most neutral people that came in was the National Guard. And that was because the general there, I think, was really, I think he was honest and fair. I mean, he had to arrest us, he had to do, but the first thing I think that the black community admired was he had been there about 3 weeks, and they had a habit of arresting black men and beating them in the jails. So he took the sheriff's people out and put his people over there so that if they were arrested, you could be sure that they wouldn't be beaten. They may have to spend time in jail, but not the brutality.
In October 1963, there was a referendum on a charter amendment in Dorchester County, which would have made discrimination on the basis of race illegal in restaurants and hotels. You were very much against holding the vote. Tell us why.
Oh, because everybody involved with CNAC, the whole Second Ward was. We had men there that had been in the World War I, World War II, and we have to vote. We were born here. Our grandparents were born. We're going to have to vote on whether we can go into what it, at that time they were calling these other little dirty restaurants. So it was a community, because CNAC was. CNAC people were responsible for them and gotten from whatever neighborhood they were in the Second Ward, so that they knew what the people on their streets and block thought. But that was really it was really ridiculous that you're going to have a referendum on whether you can go into a restaurant or not. So we chose not to participate in the vote.
So it went down.
It went down, yeah.
The segregation continued until the Civil Rights Act.
Well, with the restaurants until the Civil Rights Act, yes.
Which was passed the next year in 1964. You left Cambridge in 1964, late 1964. Why?
Let's say first that CNAC was not a 501c3. It wasn't an organization that we thought would have to exist permanently, although some of the conditions may. So once the implementation began in terms of the agreement we had, and because it wasn't a hierarchical organization, and then I decided, I met my second husband and decided to get married, and he lived in New York. So it was at that particular time when things had eased down and stuff had begun to happen that we had agreed to, that I thought this is the time, to go. And back there then, I was a civil rights worker. It's not like now where people say leaders and stuff. I think maybe it may be like Occupy. I was a voice through which people were speaking.
You knew many prominent civil rights leaders, such as Malcolm X. He mentioned you in his message to the grassroots address in November 1963. I want to listen to that part of his address.
Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders begin to stir up our people at the grassroots level.
Do you remember his address?
Yes.
What?
I don't like to hear it now because I think it's too... I get sort of upset about it.
Because of his death?
Yes, and the way he was killed. Mm-hmm. I think he was killed because the government thought that in the final analysis he would be able to lead people across this country.
So you think it was a great loss?
I think it was a deliberate death, yes. No, yes. But I think that's why. Because more and more people were becoming, like even people in Cambridge before I met him, would talk about hearing Malcolm X on the radio. I didn't really understand what that was about until I heard him in Detroit. But I think when he separated himself from Elijah Muhammad and that fake Islamic thing, mm-hmm. That he became a greater danger. Not necessarily in terms of what he thought personally, but in terms of the amount of people that he could impress. Upper middle class black folks were already listening to him in their apartments, even if they didn't admit it, outside. A lot of them admitted it after he died and it was safe. But I think he could have been, really a great leader in the old-fashioned sense.
We've been mainly talking about the past. I want to talk about the activist movement as it exists now. The Occupy protests, which started in 2011, are one of the most notable recent movements. What do you think about Occupy?
I thought it was great. I don't know. I understand they underwent a lot of repression that may not have been publicly accounted for, but Then I don't know how the media and government are reporting things, because North Carolina just had, which to me sounded like almost as big as the Washington March, from 80 to 100,000 people down there with 23 organizations, with at least a list of 10 things in North Carolina covering a variety of things in the lives of black people and poor people. And nothing in the paper, in the alternative press. But it seems to me that they would have had a lot of a broadcast, and even CNN, that's an amazing amount of people. And I think what Occupy probably scared them to death, because while people complained that they didn't have a leader, but they as a group understood, you know, what was necessary and what was going on and what the analysis was. And I think that also was true of SNCC, and certainly of CNET, because, you know, everybody understood immediately. It was like a giant organism.
Gloria Richardson, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Civil rights activist Gloria Richardson. She was one of the leaders of the Cambridge movement in the 1960s. I spoke with her in March. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.